Welcome, everybody, to the next episode of the Waking Up in South Africa podcast series. And I'm incredibly delighted on a cold and stormy Cape Town day to welcome Shannon Harvey, who's based in Western Australia. Incredibly privileged that you've taken time, Shannon, to step into conversation with me. My name is Simon Weissman, and I'll be your host through this podcast episode. Shannon is an award-winning evidence-based health journalist. I need to state that because in our conversation before we started recording, we were looking at how we name ourselves as professionals. So it's important to be clear that Shannon's work in terms of writing and documentaries has looked at a number of different aspects of health, including the mind-body connection. And more recently, an exquisite and extraordinary documentary called My Year of Living Mindfully. So this podcast is partially a prequel and preamble to a screening of this documentary, in which we will have an opportunity to also talk with Shannon in a Q&A after that screening. So stand by, everybody, for that. So welcome, Shannon. Lovely to have you here for this podcast series.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So maybe I can start with the seed for this documentary. You know, where was that planted, and how has that grown and evolved and now taken the form of this documentary? And maybe as you go through that narrative, maybe just to give an overarching view of what this documentary is about.
Okay, so to answer that question, I need to go back to about 7 years, actually, to my first feature documentary, which was called The Connection, which is about the evidence demonstrating that when it comes to chronic illnesses, we need to take a whole person approach, a whole health, whole life, whole person approach, if we really want to turn the chronic disease ship around. And that is really an exploration of the evidence demonstrating that our mind, body, and health are intimately connected. And that was a very personal documentary because I have an autoimmune disease and I was really looking for trustworthy answers and a way forward in a very murky wellness industry. And I made that film because I really wanted to share what I had learned through an exploration of the evidence with other people who might have similar questions to mine. So we released that film and I wanted to turn my mind next towards mental health. And like so many other people, my childhood involved experiencing firsthand, you know, the devastating effects of severe depression and addiction and bipolar disorder. As a child, you know, I really faced it all. And then as an adult, now facing an autoimmune disease, which is incurable, and dealing with chronic pain, I found myself really struggling with my mental health after I'd had my second child. I wouldn't say that I was in the grip of any kind of, you know, full-blown, you know, postnatal depression or, you know, a flare of post-traumatic stress or anything like that. But I was low and I wasn't flourishing. And so I thought, okay, for my next project, it's time to turn my mind to mental health. And so I went looking, and what I was looking for was something that I could do every day and something that I could potentially teach my kids to do every day that was kind of like an evidence-based mental equivalent of a 30-minute workout or the equivalent here in Australia. Our government recommends that we eat 5 fresh fruit and vegetables daily.
I think everybody recommends that. But we don't necessarily comply. Yeah, at least.
And what really stunned me when I went looking for that was that although there are recommendations for us to, you know, eat a healthy diet and get enough sleep and do things like maintain strong social networks, it wasn't really something that was like, you know, a workout for the mind. And at first I thought, wow, there really is nothing. But then I came across meta-analysis, which demonstrated that an 8-week program known as mindfulness-based cognitive therapy was shown to be equal to medication for preventing recurrent depression, which was really interesting because we know that depression often starts when we're young and it recurs throughout our lifetimes. And the idea that there was something that was the equivalent of drugs, that was a form of mental training, was really interesting. And when I looked further into it, it became really clear that mindfulness is also showing promise for other areas such as chronic pain, for some addictions, for stress and anxiety. And I thought, okay, there's something really interesting in this. And that was really the beginning of the project and the idea to see what would happen to my health and well-being if I meditated every day for a year.
And this is what makes the documentary so watchable. You know, it's not just like a whole lot of data and, you know, that article that by, I think it's William Kaiken in 2015 in The Lancet, if I'm not mistaken, is really a seminal article in the whole field. You take this evidence base and you weave it into a narrative, which is deeply personal. Those who are listening, when you watch the documentary, will see there's this really compelling storyline, which is both about you and about everyone, and then a kind of infusion of evidence and data, which creates really quite a beautiful symphony of different qualities. So I'm really curious to know, in the making of this documentary, because it was so striking to me, this combination of a kind of intimacy, but completely unsentimental at the same time. How much that shows, says, you know, how much that maybe is that like a Rorschach of you, Shannon? And so, how was it to be on the inside of that, both as producer and director, but also as the kind of the end of one, participant of one, being the reflector, being the embodiment of this exploration? How did that unfold for you on the inside?
You know, I have to be really honest with you on this one. First and foremost, extremely uncomfortable to begin with. I'm an ABC trained journalist, and so my background is that I tell other people's stories and make them matter. So putting myself in the story was something that I really took a long time to decide to do. But there's also a very personal motivation here, which is that I genuinely wanted to know if putting daily mindfulness training on my to-do list was going to be worth it. And I wanted, I think in some ways, science has become a belief system for me. It's a way that I discern what is true and what is not true in this very confusing world. And in some ways, I think that this experiment was quite an elaborate excuse for me to invite a team of scientists to validate whether or not I should be doing this.
And then we'll just make a movie about it.
Exactly, and make a movie about it as well. But as you've seen the film, and I don't want to, you know, here's a small spoiler alert for people who haven't. What became very clear about 3/4 of the way through the film was that the changes in myself as I deepened into a daily practice, and then, you know, trained for the meditation equivalent of a marathon, being a 10-day silent retreat, what became very clear is that the changes were palpable, and that, you know, it wouldn't have mattered in many ways what the scientists discovered, and that I would still be meditating, you know, beyond the 365 days regardless of what was discovered.
I wonder how that challenged you in terms of your core belief in science and evidence base. So here you know, as you say, if the evidence objectively didn't really show any change, but you had a palpable sense of on the inside, on the subject of that must be quite an interesting kind of internal tension.
Oh, you have articulated it exactly. It was a very interesting process to actually have to come to terms with this, to valuing my own subjective experience as much as what I had valued objective biological markers. And it was a really enlightening thing for me to actually understand more about how science works and how science really is, I guess, in many ways, just the best approximation of what we know so far until we know more. which is a lot like journalism. I guess that's how I reconciled it.
And in a world of distortion, especially in the media and fake news everywhere, like it becomes incredibly challenging to know what to listen to and what is true and what is not true, even if one is even asking the question. So it's an incredibly, it's its own compelling insight that your own subjective experience became the primary evidence of the value of the practice of mindfulness, and almost an auxiliary or ancillary after effect is actually there are objective changes. I'm incredibly compelled by that, and that comes through. I mean, it's not the foreground of the documentary, but it there's a kind of undercurrent of that. Like it almost, I don't know if this is true, but I guess I'm interpreting here, like an uncovering or a discovering of something about the unfolding of your inner life and how compelling it is as it evolves, as much as the objective data.
Very much so.
Which I would hope would happen if we're increasing in mindful awareness, because there's so you know, I don't know, when did you make the documentary? I know it's probably it took a year, and then so it's at least a year, maybe a fairly bit longer.
So the majority of the filming took place in 2018.
So 2 years down the line, how do you see, both with through your subjective lens and through your objective evidence-based health journalist lens, this practice of mindfulness, how do you see it now, perhaps compared to when you started this exploration?
Great question. Perhaps the most telling thing of all is the fact that I'm still meditating every single day, and that because when I began meditating, I documented my subjective experience very rigorously. So I can look back on my notes and I can pinpoint an exact period of time where, for example, improvements started happening in my mindfulness training. And I can look at what the factors were that caused those improvements. And because I've kind of got this documentary experimental record, it has kind of given me this intrinsic motivational force to keep meditating. So just to give you a really concrete example of that, I began my year of living mindfully by just simply using a meditation app and meditating for 20 minutes a day. And although there were some very clear changes that happened, for example, my insomnia improved. I had a very unbecoming habit of biting my fingernails when I was anxious, and that had stopped. But the truth is that I don't think I would have actually kept meditating at that point if not for the fact that I had this army of scientists who were tracking my every move. And so there was a kind of extrinsic cattle prod that was forcing me, so to speak, to do it. But then I came to this realization that learning mindfulness from an app is a little bit like learning a new exercise routine from YouTube in your living room. And I really needed the equivalent of a personal trainer, you know, to actually take me to the next level and inspire me and motivate me. And so I signed up for an 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction course. And what was really interesting about that was jumping up, because that program, as you know, was designed by Jon Kabat-Zinn, and he deliberately asks participants to commit to 45 minutes a day. Mm. And being the very rigorous journalist and dedicated meditator that I was, I actually did that. And there was a really clear difference to me when I began meditating under a teacher, with guidance from a teacher, and for 45 minutes a day. It was like night and day in my mental experience and the effects of that. And that, so just sort of coming back where I started with this, that kind of very rigorous accounting for my subjective experience has meant that now I'm meditating daily, but I'm committed to 45 minutes minimum a day because I know that there's an effect there.
So there's effect, but there's also something in the, let's call it the intersubjective space, where having exposure to a teacher who's guiding and who's holding and who's orientating and doing inquiry shifts your own experience of and perception of the, and perspective, I'd imagine, of the practice itself. It's very interesting because when I first meditated when I was doing my medical internship, which is way back, I'll tell you, in 1992. I realized today how long ago that feels, but it's actually not that long ago. And I, interestingly, one of the pediatric consultants who I became friendly with suggested that I meditate. And I was like, I'd heard about meditation as a medical student, but it was like, yeah, okay, that sounds interesting. If it could help me, I'd heard about TM, transcendental meditation. Well, if I can transcend all my problems, that would be a great relief. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she said, I did TM, so why don't you go and do transcendental meditation? And I did. And I was, and transcendental meditation uses a sound, a mantra, as a sound, as a focal point, mental focal point. And I was very disciplined about it. And what was the most interesting thing for me is that I had suffered from tension headaches on and off for most of my adolescence, and certainly through medical school, much more intensely. Within, I'd say, about 3 months of meditation, they disappeared almost completely. I was using analgesia every day or every second day, and they just disappeared. So there was that, there was some kind of, in this case, like experience, something shifted in my experience. Go, oh, there's something happening here that really makes it work, actually.
Yeah, it's like a knowing, isn't it?
Yeah. And in a sense, the most, I often say to people now, the most compelling evidence of the effectiveness of anything is your own experience, which is a sense what you're giving words to. Yes, you may have had the extrinsic thing. Okay, well, I'm setting up a whole documentary. I'm doing every battery, every test known to human beings under the sun. I better practice, right? But isn't it? It is one of the most important. I mean, and it's so fascinating that this is coming up as our first flag in the ground. Is the significance, almost the feedback loop of our own subjective experience as the primary evidence for the value of this approach and this practice, rather than the objective stuff might get us into it. But what's going to compel us to go forward is something much deeper than that.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, you've said it far better than I could.
So it sounds like you're, having seen the doctor, I know what you went through. It was not like you did the odd pre-course questionnaire. Like you went the full whole hog, which is quite amazing. And I was sitting I hope those results are compelling at the end, because that would have So I won't give away what was discovered, because that would spoil it. But it's so interesting that the practice is continuing for you, and that something else has emerged. But I don't know if it's true that you didn't expect. In the sense that it's beyond a year.
No. Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess in some ways I wanted to know, as I said earlier, whether or not finding time, in this very busy world where there are very heroic Highlanders to watch on Netflix during my rare moments of downtime, and whether, actually finding, making the time to meditate was, quote unquote, worth it. And I certainly got my answer, you know, because I'm still meditating. Yeah.
So here's an interesting thing, which I'd love to explore a little bit more. And it's one of the, I'd say, the single greatest gift that I've ever received from a teacher. And was when I went to do my first level of training in MBSR with John Kabat-Zinn and Saki Santarelli in 1998. I'd discovered his healing in the mind, the Bill Moyers thing, and I've read his book, Full Catastrophe Living. And I was like, there was definitely like, oh, there's something here. And I fiddle around with this, but I still, TM was my thing. That was what I'd been taught how to do. And I went to do the training, and at the end of the meditation, they'd ring the little bells, you know, the little tinctures that are the absolutely essential accoutrement for every mindfulness teacher. And they'd ring the little bells and then they'd say, right, how was that for you? And I was like, what are they doing? Like, what are they doing? You know, I'd been taught when you meditate, your brain state changes from the waking state to another state, the meditative state. And I couldn't understand why they didn't, like I'd been taught, you know, you give yourself 3 or 4 minutes and let that change of state shift back into the waking state. Then you can continue. They're just kind of, right, how was that? And I know this, for anybody listening might sound that is the most innocuous thing ever, but for me it was a big issue. And I really got quite fraught around this, and my mind went quite ballistic. Like, why are they doing it? It doesn't make any sense to me. Anyway, I eventually plucked up the courage to go and speak to John Kabat-Zinn after one of the sessions, and it was quite overwrought. And I was saying, I told him this thing about why they carry on speaking, why they give us time to get used to the waking state. And I won't give him his verbatim response. I'll give the gist of it. He extraordinarily skillfully and sensitively asked me or inquired, what am I going to do when I finish meditating? And then he put this question. He said, are you going to go back to sleep? Well, of course, I don't know what he was talking about, but I totally did. So the question then, I guess, as if this could arise as a question, is he was pointing me towards the idea of meditation being far more than a technique that you carve out time to do. That the moment you finish meditating is still the present moment, and you have this option of showing up for it. So I'm curious to know, how is that something that's unfolded for you in your exploration of this practice? Is it, and what do you see in your own experience as this relationship between meditating for 45 minutes and how that influences and infuses its way into your daily life?
I feel like I need to flag here that I'm a novice. You know, I've been meditating for 1,000 and I don't know, maybe 31 days now. And I've done some meditation courses and I've attended, you know, a few silent retreats and I've interviewed, you know, probably about 25 leading mindfulness scientists now. So I do know a lot about mindfulness, but I am a beginner. And so, you know, when I hear a story like that, that you've just told, you know, I've just absorbed a lesson. And I guess I was really reminded as you were sharing that about the fact that it's not just about the training. You know, the training is preparing us for, you know, the other 23 hours in our day. And it's a lot for me, like, if I could use the metaphor again of exercise, you know, I try to take time out every day to actually physically move my body for a variety of reasons. You know, exercise is good for me, but I do it because it makes me better able to run around and play with my kids and to lift my son up into the car and to carry the groceries into the house and, you know, to stop my body, my arthritic body from seizing up. And so I don't enjoy exercise, but I do it because it has an effect in my life. It makes me stronger and healthier and fitter and weller in my life. And my mindfulness training something, and I'll share this with you, something that John said to me about it, you know, that's sort of along these lines, is that it's, you know, some people struggle with the idea that sitting down to take time out to meditate is a really selfish thing, and that you're cultivating, you know, your ego, and it's this really, you know, it's self-help, you know, it's a self-help fad, and it's all about, you know, we're trying to sculpt ourselves into some ideal human being. But John said that actually it's the biggest gift you can give other people is to cultivate mindfulness and to put the training in. And that's actually one of my motivational forces now, is because I know that what happens when I'm not sitting is actually taking effect in my daily life. Mm. Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah. So we don't just practice for ourselves. Mm. And we do. I mean, the obvious analogy comes to mind. You know, we do physical distancing and wear masks, not just for ourselves, but for everybody. You know, and implicit in this is an understanding of a kind of deeper embedded or interconnectedness that a lot of the wisdom teachings refer to. But we don't have to know anything about those wisdom teachings to spontaneously start to recognize this ourselves, that I'm not just doing it for myself. But I, speaking of masks and physical distancing, I know that down in Australia, they just reimposed a significant lockdown in your region, and we are 100 plus days into the pandemic. And I'm wondering how, you know, you must have had a particular trajectory for the My Year of Living Mindfulness, My Year of Living Mindfully documentary, which went out the window, no doubt. So I'm just wondering how has that been for you, and actually have there been any kind of positive spin-offs? And what is the plan of how you are working with using the documentary in this unusual COVID pandemic time, both in terms of marketing and promotion, but also how you view the value of the documentary in terms of the impact of the virus pandemic on our mental health?
Wow. Okay. So it was interesting because I've written a book as well that accompanies the documentary, and I was putting the finishing touches on the epilogue, which was about COVID-19 and the fact that, you know, when I started the project, all the mental health data was already tracking in all the wrong directions. And now we're in this post-COVID world where, you know, who knows what's going to happen next. What happened was we were premiering the film in March in North America, and we were then going to be following on with 150 screenings around the world. It was a very exciting time. Mm. And then COVID-19 happened right in the middle of the film festival where we were screening. Oh. And the festival was shut down. I flew home 2 days before the borders closed. Immediately went into quarantine, and we had all this momentum going for the film release, and we decided to do a pivot. We felt that now was probably a time more than ever when people needed this information, and we decided to do an online pivot. And within 6 weeks, our very small team turned around and we had a free global online premiere. And that went for a 7-day window, and we had an extraordinary response. The film was seen in 51 countries around the world by hundreds of thousands of people. info@shannonharvey.com inbox sort of exploded. And it was really, really excellent. But I can tell you it was the most challenging thing I've done in my career to do that with two small children who were at home. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I can barely imagine the disappointment of having everything lined up and the excitement of going around the world and having given birth to this piece and then just disappearing literally overnight.
Yes. You know, but what was really funny about it was that, and we're sort of a month on from all of that really happening, is that when I was in it, I kept thinking of COVID as affecting other people. So I was putting the finishing touches on the epilogue of my book, and I was writing about COVID and how it's going to change the mental health landscape and how we're already so challenged and what are we facing now. And I was writing it as though COVID-19 was affecting other people. And it wasn't affecting me, and I'm the lucky one. And I hadn't had insomnia once throughout that particular period. And I am a lifelong insomniac. I have had insomnia since I was a teenager. And I 100% attribute that to my mindfulness practice.
Extraordinary. I have to say that, you know, how things unfold is a little bit mysterious. I know that mystery is not part of the mindfulness practice, but there is a mystery. It's like the fact that we're having this conversation. Because I'm not sure that I would have, I mean, maybe down the line I would have heard about it. But somebody, I didn't even know how it landed up in my WhatsApp. So check this out quickly before it disappears. And was so impacted by it and then reached out to you. I was one of those myriad of emails in your inbox. So thank you for responding. So it sounds like have at least up to now reached perhaps more people than you would have if you'd done the literal physical screening. So it's different and there is a loss, but there's a gain as well in terms of the exposure, the online exposure.
Yeah, I think you might be right. Yeah.
We hope so. Well, certainly if I think now about the time that we're in and we're in the pandemic, we have no idea where it's unfolding, how it's going to unfold and what the impact, but we were speaking before we started recording about this amplification of the fault lines and that your doorway into this documentary was mental health. So I would imagine that with the pandemic, there's going to be an amplification of the fault lines of an existing mental health crisis globally.
I hope not. I hope that is not the case, but sadly, I think that's the trajectory.
Yeah, it might very well. And I wonder also, you know, you sitting in Australia where, you know, the geographic and social context is very different from where we are in South Africa. And, you know, all the mental health and the physical health and the social health parameters and dynamics are really, really different. So it's a question that I guess I have, like, can mindfulness be a value, and is mindfulness a value in this context, you know, with high degrees of trauma and poverty and inequality, which is leads me to, I guess, a question that is open-ended firstly, but wanted to link that with a piece of the documentary, which is when your trip to the Middle East. And I know this is also going to, spoiler alert, that this is one of the most amazing parts. But without giving too much away, Shannon, I'd love to hear how that was for you, you know, stepping into that cauldron of Middle East refugee camps, working, seeing and exposed to refugees and the work that's being done there. Because there is perhaps a way in which what we're dealing with in South Africa and some of the very significant health issues is there's a relevance that comes in through that part of the documentary. So I'd love to know a little bit about how that lived inside you, how that was for you to be exposed in that way, given where you'd come from and what you'd learned up to that point.
Oh, so just to give you a little bit of context for the listeners, the beginning of the experiment, one of the reasons why I landed on mindfulness was because I actually set up quite a, you know, rigid criteria as to what kind of solutions I was looking for if we were going to actually make a meaningful dent in the mental health crisis. And the criteria were along the lines of that it needed to be accessible to anybody, regardless of their life circumstances and their educational opportunities. It needed to be something that could be easily disseminated. You know, one of the really scary things that I learned in the initial setup is, you know, when you look at the fact that every country in the world, every country, for you guys in South Africa, for us in Australia, every single country in the world was facing and failing to tackle the host of mental health issues. And so what we needed to do is we needed to think of something that could be disseminated at scale. And what became really clear about three quarters of the way through the project was that mindfulness was effective for me, but I am an educated white woman living in a peaceful country. And, you know, after I sort of had developed my own subjective well-being, I felt like I had the capacity to turn my mind to others who were suffering. I kind of had an inner capacity to help others and came back to the original premise of the story, which is how I ended up in the Middle East, the front line of a global humanitarian crisis in which more people have been displaced by conflict and famine and war than since World War II. And it's really one thing to read about this situation and, you know, watch videos on the internet and, you know, hear compelling accounts from my colleagues who are journalists working in the area. But to actually travel there and see it for myself was a completely different scenario. And, you know, to give you an idea, one of the camps that I visited, the Zaatari refugee camp, which was at the time one of the largest refugee camps in the world, right on the border of Syria and Jordan, in which there are about 75 or 80,000 people, there is one psychiatrist available in that camp. One. And so when you think about the kind of the trauma that those people are going and you know more than me about intergenerational trauma, and you think about those kids that are being born in the refugee camp, and I met them. And they, one moment that really hit me was that I met a beautiful family, a single mother who had six kids, and her six-year-old daughter was the same age as my six-year-old son. And we didn't speak the same language. We came from completely different cultures. But, you know, we both sort of had a commonality as parents who were worried about children, our children. Mm. And I just, at that point, I really wondered how really in that kind of scale, how could mindfulness really help? Mm-hmm. And that's where I traveled across the border to Israel, where Professor Amit Bernstein from the University of Haifa has developed a 9-week program called Mindfulness-Based Trauma Recovery for Refugees, in which he was basically running a clinical study to determine whether or not this program could help a group of East African refugees who are, by their data, some of the most traumatized people on the planet. And really that was a moment for me, a quite powerful moment, because I met some of those refugees who were involved in the program and involved in the clinical study. And one of them, whose name was Dawit, he was the cultural facilitator. And at the end of all our filming, when everything was wrapped up, he quietly took me aside after we'd all kind of sat down and shared a beautiful meal together prepared by some of the Eritrean women. And he told me his story, and he wasn't actually technically one of the participants. He was the cultural facilitator. And he said he was a former child soldier. You know, he'd made the perilous journey across the border through the Sinai Desert. He was working as a counsellor, you know, in the sort of the very makeshift call centre for East Africans. And just to put this in context, they're living in South Tel Aviv, and we're talking tens of thousands of East Africans who don't have an asylum status. They're not refugees, they're asylum seekers. Anyhow, Dawit was listening, you know, 3 days a week to the, you know, the horrible stories of torture from people who were calling this hotline. So he had, you know, what you and I would probably just call baggage. He had a lot going on. But he said to me that if somebody offered him 10,000 Israeli shekel or mindfulness training, he would take the mindfulness training, because it was the first time in his life that somebody had taught him how to solve his own problems. And he said, I don't want handouts. I don't even, you know, I don't want the government to build me a house or give me a status. I just want somebody to help me help myself. Mm. And he turned to Amit Bernstein, and this all happened off camera, I'm sorry to say. So it didn't make it into the film, but he turned to Amit Bernstein and he said, this is the best thing that has ever happened in my life. And Amit, who was translating for me, was moved to tears, which was quite a powerful thing. So that was really a very powerful moment of conviction for me as a critical thinking health journalist. Yeah.
What an incredible story. And I say I can feel my heart moving to the edge of tears as you tell it. Is that I can't remember who's a famous French poet. He said we should live to the edge of tears. But you know what it brings to my mind is that, like, there's something in the essential quality of mindfulness, which people often talk about it as kindfulness or heartfulness. And I think often that can get really lost in the evidence base. But it's when you have those experiences, then you start to see. And I think this has come through incredibly poignantly and powerfully in that story you've just told and in your own story. But I'm seeing in this country, and we grapple with this question all the time, you know, how to make an impact at scale. That's its own question. But does mindfulness even work with linguistic and cultural and socioeconomic and racial trauma, all these factors? And it strikes me in hearing this again is like the heartfulness is what's going to carry us. Yeah. And not just a mental training. It is a mental training, but it's also a heart training or a kindfulness training. And so that comes through, I think, is incredibly inspirational. It just that story embodies so much of the possibility. So thank you. Because that you're not going to get on the documentary. So this documentary succeeds that in to a huge degree. And as such, you know, a huge bar of gratitude to you for creating it, for literally that a work of art, I would say. And hopefully that here in South Africa we can contribute to the growing movement of that documentary, not simply because it's a great documentary, because it's an important piece of media that can help people, maybe invite people or remind people of what's possible to take care of themselves and each other. For all our listeners, I hope you enjoyed this podcast.